Okay, so this is session 5 in Christian's Guide to the Enlightenment, and I think we've got this one and the next one. Our second session today will wrap up Descartes. But let me just do a little bit of review of Descartes, just so we can remember where we've come from, where we're going. 17th century, early to mid-17th century. You got the 30 Years' War going on in Europe. You got Roman Catholics and Reformed Protestants debating the question of authority. Where do we know truth from? That creates a crisis of authority. Descartes happens to be enlisted in the army on the German front for the French army. And while he's there, he has this epiphany. It's kind of his tower moment, except it's his cardinal legend. It's his Dutch oven moment. And I actually think whether that's true or not, it's actually the perfect metaphor for what rationalism actually is and what it tries to do. Is instead of a monastery keeping out sin in the Middle Ages, it's a Dutch oven, just representing his mind, keeping out things like sense perception, the reasoning of other people, so authority, his own experience. And the reason he's in there is because as he traveled the world, and as he read regular books, and what he calls the book of himself, and the book of the world, he realized that none of this was really trustworthy as an actual foundation. And so you had all these people confused about what their authority was. You had skepticism on the rise in France with Montaigne. And Descartes basically said, well, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to doubt everything that I can possibly doubt. And so he does. And he takes you through that. He says, well, the senses, they can deceive us. And even our mathematical reasonings, even though it's about certain things in themselves, it doesn't follow that our reason is the same thing as that. And he's right about that. I wish he would have stuck to that. But he said, you know, our judgments are not infallible. And then he looks at experience through dreams in this case. He says, well, who can even tell when we're awake and when we're asleep? So he goes really extreme, kind of matrix-level doubt here. And he takes you on that journey. And one of the ways that we describe that is with the old foundation, which is cracked. We drew those four things up, the senses and reasoning and authority and experience. And this was representing the old house of knowledge. And what he was saying is that this is already cracked. This is already no good. So his skepticism, which we represented by a wrecking ball or a jackhammer or whatever, we had several different pictures there, that is representing a momentary use of skepticism. He is not a skeptic. He's a rationalist. He gets rid of this, and in so doing, he is attempting to build up a new foundation for all of our knowledge. And there's a reason there's layers, and that they're going to move as he does his demolition. They're going to move this way. And he realizes that he's doubting all the things he can possibly doubt. There's this one thing that he can't possibly doubt. He realizes that he's thinking these thoughts. He came up with that famous maxim, I think, therefore I am. And so we put on the bottom rung here, I think, dot, 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 and then right above it, therefore, I am. And I tried to, my best to get the kids to focus on that last week. Why would therefore I am come above, I think? And the answer is, in logic, this is what you call a consequent, and this is an antecedent. So this is your ground. So the whole thing's your foundation for your new house. But why is I think foundational to therefore I am? And the answer was because this was his axiom that he is thinking. Now here's the problem with that. He does prove analytically that if he is thinking, he definitely exists. The problem with it is that though he can show what this is, he can't show that it is. He can't show it to somebody else. It doesn't follow from his, I think, therefore I am, that he thinks. So that's a conditional proof. It's not a genuine foundation such as the rationalists were looking for. But you see what this is doing. The function of this, the reason for this, is so that he can find some first principle of deduction, some axiom, some foundational truth. He used the expression clear and distinct ideas. But this has to be an indubitable idea, one that can't be doubted, one that if I try to deny it, I actually wind up affirming it. Now, I would have suggested the law of non-contradiction, the law of identity, and so on for that. But anyway, that actually represents, his way of demonstrating that actually represents what the rationalists do in general, which is that they turn inward. But then last time, we talked about something good, about not so much about rationalism, but chewing the meat and spitting out the bones. There is something very important in this that that the rationalists at least have better than the empiricists. And last time, you remember, we looked at reason being over nature. And there's a lot of ways, I guess, you could demonstrate this, but that's just... Reason is over against nature here. Reason is not necessarily over against revelation. Now, other rationalists would come along and pit those two against each other. Descartes didn't do that explicitly. You can say that what Descartes was doing is so focused on our own steam, so to speak, reasoning apart from the scriptures, for example, would be one way to say it. So you can say that the focus becomes so one-dimensional and rationalistic that you do pit reason against revelation. But that's not what Descartes was trying to do. He was pitting reason against nature. Reason against the senses, which we'll talk more about today. Okay, so that's the good part about natural. He looks at the laws of nature, showing that even science is always reason over nature. What is it that tells you such and such? Is it your senses or is it your reason? And he shows that it is your reason. This part of what Descartes is saying is just classical Christianity. Now, the other thing that's good, we're gonna criticize this a lot, but notice that one thing that we're not going to say is bad is that there is a foundation, and that foundation is certain. So the idea of certainty and the need for a foundation is not the problem. Today, I'm going to put the second dirty word up there today, but the first dirty word we looked at last week, foundationalism. Today, pick a book, any book, if it mentions this subject at all, this is bad. Foundationalism. Now, in the Enlightenment, the idea was to move beyond revelation and to find some clear and distinct idea apart from God's truth. Okay, that would be bad. But what's bad about that is not that there is a foundation and not that the foundation is certain. We looked at those thinkers last week that basically said, well, if I have this, then I'm going to try to extend that certainty to everything else in the house. If I have certainty at the foundation, I'm going to develop a need for certainty everywhere else. And so this one particular author, Stanley Grenz, drew a straight line from Descartes through Protestant scholasticism to the Princeton school in the 19th century to the doctrine of biblical inerrancy. The idea is that if I have an error-free foundation, then I have an error-free Bible. I think the way he said it was a doubt-free foundation gives you or necessitates an error-free Bible. So you see, and they actually talk about it as if it is a psychosis, as if it is something that is an anxiety that we have, the need to erase any uncertainty. Okay? So that's the first dirty word, foundationalism. We'll talk about the second one today. Obviously, there's a lot of catching up. If anybody missed, you can check on the website and catch up to this stuff. It's incredibly practical for the Christian books that are written today. There's a lot of sloppy history of philosophy going on and a lot of worldview cargo getting smuggled into our minds when we might be reading books on mission or something like that. And this stuff is getting smuggled in a way that you can't possibly, critically be examining it, or where's this coming from and where's it going? So that's why we're doing this. Okay, so the fifth session today is called God, Truth, and Error to the Rationalist. How does a rationalist, particularly Descartes, from a Christian perspective, at least he's trying from a Christian perspective, I guess is the charitable way to say it, how do they look at God, truth, and error? And really, we're not going to be departing far. That's the thing you'll get from Descartes' two little books. He's going in these cycles of explaining his journey of demolition and rebuilding. It happens about 5 or 6 times. In a sense, there's really nothing in the two books except for him continuing to walk you through that cycle again. He just draws out more, says it in different ways when he continues on talking about it. So now he's going to review again and get to that point. So if I could do a little bit more review, because he's going to do it again. He's going to get you to that point where he starts rebuilding. And when he does, here's another way to look at what we just looked at. He starts with the self, the I, thinking. He realizes his imperfections and argues from imperfection to a perfect idea. So we had self, God, the truth of other things, and then sense perception and the external world. That's kind of the way, the order he operates in. Now, how do people see that today? Oh, so I came first, then God? It's not what he's saying. He's talking about a method of knowing things, okay? So it's pretty important to know that. I'm not defending him, because there's problems with that. But it's pretty important to say what he's saying and what he's not saying. But the fundamental problem with the whole thing is that he's turning inward. In everything he's talking about, he's turning inward. Okay? He's not turning outward. In other words, rationalism is not an objective view. Rationalism is explicitly a subjective term. All the books today will tell you the exact opposite, which tells you they don't understand the meaning of the words subjective and objective. Okay? There is an inward term, subjective. Again, just a little review grammar. When we talk about subjective and objective in philosophy, the subject is the knower, the object is the thing known. So not subject as in the subject of a sentence. In philosophy, the subject is the knower, and the object is the thing known. So if I say truth is objective, what I mean is, truth means the reality of that thing represented in the mind that is what it is, whether I like it or not, whether I agree with it or not, whether everybody, let God be true though everyone were a liar, Romans 3:4. That's objective truth. Subjective truth is just, well, you got your truth, I got my truth, that whole thing that we call postmodernism today. In other words, postmodernism is actually, at this very important point, falling off of the tree of Descartes. In other words, modernism and postmodernism, the difference between them, one is just sort of the confident young man at that stage of his life, and postmodernism is just sort of the old tired man. But it's the same man embarking on the same journey. We'll come back to that. So Descartes turns inward again. When he brings you on his method, he turns inward. He sees the supremacy of the rational, namely the internal. When the rationalists start thinking about the rational, rational starts to mean internal. You say, how did that happen? It means internal against the external. But just when Descartes looks to be distinguishing between philosophical certainty and a merely clear and distinct idea, he equates them. So one of the ways this happens is that he starts judging everything by it being a clear and distinct idea. Well, what's the basic, and you could even put as a synonym for certain, self-evident. In fact, if you hadn't gone to any of these classes, what do you tend to think of when you think of self-evident? How would you, forget about how you would define this, maybe you would define it perfectly right, but how do you think most people out there would define self-evident today? Yeah, or evident to the self, or evident to enough selves, or somebody might object to it by saying, that's not self-evident. Most people wouldn't. You hear what's happening there? They're hearing self. In other words, they're not talking about the thing anymore. They're immediately turning inward and understanding its clarity to me to be the ground of its certainty, or to mean the same thing as certainty. Okay? So, he doesn't make that distinction. He says, everything I very clearly and distinctly perceive is true. Now, if it's a thing, now if by that you mean everything clearly and distinctly seen by me is true, and you're defining it as a thing up front, then you're talking about the thing, and then that would be true. But if you mean in that sentence, everything I see clearly, namely everything that's clear to me, then you have that inward turn. And that's exactly what you see in rationalism. All right. So clearly and distinctly become, in the course of his writing, references to his own act of perceiving and not to the truth as it is, but to his own act of perceiving. And so following from that first book, the Discourse on Method, he moves again to the outside world. What is outside of us is not actually perceived at all. There's two senses of the word perceive. There's, if I say perceive, I can mean something rationally perceived, the eyes of the mind, or I can mean something like the five senses. And so Descartes wants to resist something like empiricism. He wants to resist the supremacy of things outside of him coming in the physical world. Not revelation per se, but in the physical world. He wants to show reason's superiority to the senses. And so in order to do that, he makes a perfectly valid, yet perfectly misleading statement. He says this. It's not that long of a statement, but just try to listen carefully to this. He says, and finally, even if these ideas did proceed from things other than myself, he's talking about sense impressions, even if these things did proceed from things other than myself, it does not therefore follow that they must resemble those things. So you see that. Just because those things outside of me aren't, not coming from will, actually he says that later on, sorry, let me just draw some more pictures up here. I realize at 6 in the morning that we're not caught up. It's like getting back into a book or getting back into working out when your muscles are atrophying or whatever else. But I'll use a lot of these expressions. These are really weak expressions, like sense perception or even sense data. Those are very misleading, but the idea is that they're kind of, like sound waves or something like that. Now, the perception, what Descartes is going to want to press here, is that not only is sense data very misleading, but when we say this, what's doing, he's going to put that in quotes. Let me just put that in quotes for him. He's going to be saying, what is actually doing that? Is it the thinking thing, or is it what he called the extended thing, the body? Okay? That's going to be very, very crucial. Descartes is pitting the thinking thing against the extended thing. He's not necessarily pitting reason against revelation. That's absolutely crucial. But he moves on from the reality of external objects to the idea of perfection. Remember that progression over there. He moves from himself to thinking, and then he realizes he's not perfect in his thoughts, which we kind of laughed at that, but he doesn't mean what he seems to be saying. He's showing an argument sort of similar to Aquinas did, from imperfection of things to perfect things, from lesser things to greater things. And he's focusing on his ideas of things, his thoughts, his knowledge. Okay, so he moves on from the reality of external objects to the idea of perfection, reasoning that there is more objective reality in the ultimate cause of things than any of the effects. And so the idea of God must be the most real idea. The idea of God, all the things I'm thinking about in things out here, contain in imperfections. What is perfect in God? So the goodness of something, the redness of a rose, or the beauty of a rose, or anything else like that, are things, and this is just classic realism, but he doesn't make reference to that. He wants to get beyond the scholastics. Okay, so he reasons from these things to the perfection of God. Not just the imperfection of his own thoughts, that he needs more knowledge, but the imperfection in these things. The attributes that we give to these things are attributes that are not explained by those things. They have to be explained by eternal attributes. And then he gets to the real crux of, and we left this off last week. I had this in my notes, so I pasted it in this week so we can cover it, because I think it's a good picturesque example. He uses the example of a piece of wax melting. And it's probably the second or third most famous piece of imagery that Descartes uses after the idea of the house or the mythical Dutch oven. This is kind of a third sort of famous example that he uses. And what he's going to try to show, it doesn't matter what the object is he's looking at. He happens to be looking at a piece of wax. It's going to be melting in a fire. Let's just draw that. Let's just draw the fire. Let's go with it. Let's just draw a little square. I don't remember what shape he said. And then he's actually going to be holding this with, I've never drawn this in my life, so I'm just making this up. It's just, one of the things that goes in the fire. He's holding it. Let's just go with that. He's going to take it, and he's going to hold it over the fire. Okay? So those are kind of our three pieces that we need in this picture. So he uses the example of a wax, and the reason he's doing this and what he's going to show, he's going to defend the idea that the categories of the mind are the things that impose all of the perceptions on the senses. Okay? So he's going to show the categories of the mind are the thing that are going to make this object to be what it is. There's going to be nothing in the physical realm, per se, that is itself apart from mind. And immediately you're going to think, oh, subjectivism. But just listen carefully to what he's saying and what he's not saying. So take the wax. It's fresh from the honeycomb. He says it's cold, it's hard, it makes a noise when you tap it. And he continues, as I'm speaking, I guess he wants to show you this so picturesque that he's actually doing it while he's writing, that kind of thing. But he says, as I'm speaking, I'm bringing it close to the fire. The remaining traces of the honey flavor are disappearing. The scent is vanishing. The color is changing. The original shape is disappearing. Its size is increasing. It is becoming liquid and hot. You can hardly touch it. And now when you rap on it, it no longer emits any sound. Does the same wax still remain? He says, I must confess that it does. No one denies it. No one thinks otherwise. So what was there in the wax that was so distinctly grasped? Certainly none of the aspects that I reached by means of the senses. For whatever came under the senses of taste, smell, sight, touch, or hearing has now changed. And yet the wax remains. So what on earth is he getting at? What he's getting at is the same thing we looked at in Aquinas. We looked at the blue ball. We also looked at the scrap of lumber that turns into the table. Okay? What he's saying there is that if you take every single secondary attribute out of this, the only thing you actually have there you can describe is something that the mind is describing, and when it's describing it, it's describing something ultimately invisible. For example, you might have thought of that as you heard that and said, well, Descartes just didn't know enough about, the subatomic level and stuff like that. Okay, tell me something about the subatomic level. And that will also be something that's changing and is being affected by something else. And so his point still stands. There's no thing there except for metaphysical properties, invisible things that are objects of the mind. Its squareness. If you chop at it, make it a rhombus, does square go away or does square exist? You say, well, that's silly. It's the material. It's the wax itself. Even he said, the wax remains. Well, what's that? What's the chemical composition that makes that up? And so on and so on and so forth. And so there's nothing in this physical universe that's actually a real thing, except insofar as it is participating in eternal, unchanging things. And so Descartes' focus is not so much on, there's nothing there, it's all in your mind, we're in the matrix. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, there's nothing there that is not participating or reflecting something that is metaphysical. Okay? So at that point, at least, Descartes is at one with Plato. You have an invisible realm up here. Plato called it the forms. Justice itself, beauty itself, oneness itself, squareness itself. And if you really want to get into it, waxness itself, and so on and so forth. And so Plato recognized three different realms. The realm of the senses, the realm of the mind, and this realm of the forms. And there was a pretty clear hierarchy among them. So Descartes is going to agree with Plato up to that point. But Descartes is going to so press the internal of the mind versus the external of the senses that he's actually going to mean something less subjective than Plato did. And this is going to be the turn of Western philosophy inward. Inward to the self. Okay, that's a very important distinction to make at this point. The great crime of Descartes is not that he's resting things in a foundation. It's not that he's being objective in his thinking. It's the opposite. He's being subjective in his thinking. He just happens to see this clearly and distinctly. Okay? Well, the reason why God alone remains objectively external with certainty is that his superiority over all other things is formal. So ultimate reality is formal. Now, in the modern world, when we hear something like that, I suppose you might think, so ultimate reality is abstract, so ultimate reality is not as real as... That's what we hear. In fact, I'll never forget, when I was 22, I was getting this job somewhere, and I was already a philosophy major, and I guess in the interview, the guy asked me, you know, what major, and I said philosophy. He's like, oh, you like looking at abstract things. I actually wanted to hit him for some reason. Abstract things. As if what I said was pink unicorns or a burning in my bosom. Okay, that's what we hear in the modern world. Okay? It's exactly reverse. By the way, that's naturalism. That's atheism. Most Christians in America are practical atheists because philosophically we've learned our grammar of these words from unbelievers, from the culture. Well, at any rate, Descartes makes a slightly better explanation of his inference from the imperfect to the perfect at this point. When he's contemplating this, so what does this have to do with God? He's moving up this way. He makes in his second book, he makes a slightly better go at God being the perfect form. He says, "Nor should I think that I do not perceive the infinite by means of a true idea, but only through a negation of the finite." Okay, so stop right there. He's going to keep saying that in different ways. He's going to give you examples. But what he just said, I don't perceive the infinite by means of the true idea. In other words, I don't grasp infinity except by means of negation, that it's infinite. Now he's going to give you some examples. He's going to draw that out. He's going to say, just as I perceive rest and darkness by means of a negation of motion and light. So rest is the negation of motion. Darkness is the negation of light. On the contrary, I clearly understand that there is more reality in an infinite substance than there is in a finite one. Thus, the perception of the infinite is somehow prior in me to the perception of the finite. Stop right there. Descartes, even though he's going to make all these mistakes, he does get, there's like 20 different points in his books where he gets everything that he's criticized for in the postmodern world. He understands that revelation comes before reason. It's just not what he wants to emphasize. And so he admits it here. He says, thus, the perception of the infinite is somehow prior in me to the perception of the finite. Okay? Again, I'm not saying he's going to get this right or that his epistemology is going to be perfectly consistent with a fully biblical epistemology. It's not. But right here, he's saying, if I perceive the infinite only in terms of the finite, just like I only perceive rest in terms of motion, darkness in terms of light, then that shows that even though I fully grasp imperfection, that perfection, therefore, had to be understood by me first. I may not have talked about it, but it's an innate idea, is what he's going to call it. So he says, that is, my perception of God is prior to my perception of myself. For how would I understand that I doubt and that I desire, that is, that I lack something, that I am not wholly perfect, unless there were some idea in me of a more perfect being by comparison with which I might recognize my defects. Now, if he would have just made a U-turn right there and said, okay, well, if that's in me before this even, maybe I should go back there and build a new foundation under I think, therefore I am. He doesn't, and that's where he goes wrong. But he does see that revelation precedes reason. In order for him to say all of these things, he's saying the knowledge of God already has to be there for reasoning to take place, for our imperfect reason. So, I wish he would have done that. He didn't, but it's worth pointing out. Another criteria he gives for clear and distinct ideas is that some perfection is wholly contained in that idea. So a clear and distinct idea is at least this, it's at least one that contains some perfection in that idea. He says that while it is true that my knowledge is gradually being increased and that there are many things in me potentially that are not yet actual, nevertheless, none of these pertains to the idea of God, in which there is nothing whatever that is potential. He's not saying that his idea of God is perfected. He's saying that the idea of God is the idea of perfection, just like infinity. I can't count to infinity, but I understand what it means. And in the same way, I don't have perfect thoughts of God, but I understand by negation what perfection must mean, and that I'm not that. All right. He then proceeds to argue in a way that's weaker than the scholastics did, but it's the same kind of argument. He goes on in his next breath to say, for nothing more perfect than God, or even as perfect as God, can be thought or imagined. But if I got, now stop right there. Right there, he's assuming some stuff that Anselm said. He's saying that if you have a more perfect idea in your mind, well, then that other thing you were thinking about is not God. So at that point, he's assuming a lot that medieval philosophy had already talked about. Nothing more perfect than God, or even as perfect as God, can be thought or imagined. But if I got my being from myself, I would not doubt, nor would I desire, nor would I lack anything at all. For I would have given myself all the perfections of which I had some idea. And in so doing, I myself would be God. Now that's a weaker argument, because he's telling you what you would do. If I found out that I lacked things, that I lacked happiness, that I had limits, and I'm God, well then I would just give myself those things. That's not the strongest way to argue. Because then you're sort of making it subjective again. And that, again, is what Descartes is guilty of. Even when he's grasping something that the scholastics did back in the Middle Ages and he gets it right, he still has this tendency to turn inward and to make all of his arguments depend on what he would do and what he can do and what you can see clearly and so forth. And that represents that subjective turn. All right, but he wraps up this section basically saying that if a thinking thing is analytically greater than a non-thinking thing, and if no perfection can be the effect of that which is less than perfect, then it must follow that the sufficient cause of a thinking thing is a greater thinking thing. And so this is how he arrives at his idea of God. It must be a greater thinking thing. Now, you can charge him at this point of having a God that's no greater than Aristotle's God, a perfect thought. A perfect thought, thinking perfectly about himself. That's kind of all he does. He thinks, and therefore he is, apparently. Okay, but he doesn't necessarily have any emotion or care for us. I think that's a leap, and I think that's uncharitable to Descartes to say that. But certainly, if you make your arguments this week, that's kind of what you're left with. Any questions before I get to his discussion of the necessity of truth? That's kind of the way he sees the necessity of God and reason over the senses. Remember the team he's on here. He's positioning God as the perfect thinker and reason over against the senses. You may not like that language. There are things that it falls short of, but just so we don't slander him and get all of history wrong after that, it's not him and reason against revelation. It's reason presupposing revelation against the senses. Any questions? Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you look at this setup right here, the realm of the senses, the realm of the intellect, and the realm of the forms in heaven, or wherever for Plato, that there's going to be agreement on. It's his emphasis. That's probably a good way to say it's his emphasis. He's just going to keep emphasizing when he uses the words clear and distinct, that's probably the best example. When he uses the phrases clear and distinct ideas as a basis for what's true, clarity starts to mean and certainty starts to mean subjective certainty, subjective clarity. So there's an inward turn that you don't see in Plato. For Plato, these are, at best, representations of this, but the object up here is the thing that's worth talking about, not the perception of objects, however clear they might be. So that's the whole game right there. It is a subjective inward turn, which again is the exact opposite picture you get today about Descartes. All right. He answers objections on his proof for the necessity of truth. By the way, this whole second book, he's answering objections from the first book, his demonstration for himself, for God, and then for the necessity of truth, and then the existence of external objects, the reliability of sense perception. By the way, Descartes is not against sense perception. I hope I'm not giving anybody that idea. The title of the first book makes it clear that he is for science, and he wants to provide a better foundation for science. But he wants to provide a rationalistic foundation for science. Okay. So meditation 4, and there's 6 of them. Meditation 4 is on the true and the false. And again, it's interesting where he starts. Even the rationalist has to start with God. And especially if he is a professing Christian, which Descartes was. Here's the way he reasons. Since God is not a deceiver, it follows that his gift of reason doesn't fail when I use it properly. Now that is loaded on both ends there, okay? Since God is not a deceiver, it follows that his gift of reason doesn't fail. Now stop right there. That's good, and that's a line of argumentation that biblical Christians use all the time, for example, for the doctrine of biblical inerrancy. Since God is not a deceiver, therefore everything he says is true. Well, there's a lot of other assumptions going on there. But that's basically a valid line of reasoning. The reason I'm bringing it up here is because Descartes is a rationalist. He's not supposed to assume anything about revelation that's just given. Okay? Unless he's done a better job explaining why God cannot deceive, which he doesn't do. Since God is not a deceiver, here's the other loaded part at the end. This is the more mischievous one. It follows that his gift of reason doesn't fail when I use it properly. His gift of reason doesn't fail when I use it properly. Well, isn't that another way of saying that you are God's gift to reason? When I use it properly? So like if the parachute doesn't open? I mean, if my reasoning fails me in this definition, I can always turn on revelation as the culprit. Well, it's not working properly, God. And so maybe God is a deceiver, or something like that. Well, Descartes is only talking about this because he's contemplating the idea of error. And he goes from this contemplation of error to some interesting places. Not all bad. He contemplates that error is bad. And since God doesn't will bad or do bad, therefore, God's ends must escape our grasp. Well, that's pretty interesting for a rationalist. Good. Let's draw that up. God never does, let's just shorthand it by, let's say God never does bad. Premise 2, error is bad. Now he's assuming error exists, so that's a hidden premise, but I don't think he's feeling too anxious to prove that. Error is bad. Therefore, God's ends must escape us. In other words, there's some things God's doing that we're just never going to know. Interesting line of argument. Not the kind of thing you would put in a textbook on logic because there's a lot of hidden premises there. But it's still good. What does he do here? He's French. It's a couple generations after the Huguenots had been exterminated. Well, maybe he'll become a Calvinist. Well, I don't think he does. But the very nature of error drives him to seek out the nature of his own being and the nature of God. He reasons that error is the privation of truth. Error is the lack of truth. And therefore, he sees that truth, just like goodness, ought to be in him. Error is a privation of truth, and truth ought to be in him. And right there at that point, instead of seeing that as a manifestation of sin, he turns like a mirror the problem into his definition of God. Rather than seeing something wrong. Now, he's going to see something wrong with himself, but here's how he does it. He says, quote, "When I attend to the nature of God, it seems impossible that he would have placed in me a faculty that is not perfect in its kind." So, perfect in its kind. Not perfect like God is perfect, but perfect in its kind. "Or that is lacking some perfection it ought to have. For if it is true that the more expert the craftsman, the more perfect the works he produces, then what can the supreme creator of all things make that is not perfect in all respects?" Now, what is he doing? He's melting the problem of evil into the problem of epistemology. He's mixing them together. And it's not a bad thing to do in and of itself. But just watch the solution. "No doubt God could have created me such that I never erred. No doubt, again, God always wills what is best. Is it then better that I should be in error rather than not? As I mull these things over more carefully, it occurs to me first that there is no reason to marvel at the fact that God should bring about certain things, the reasons for which I do not understand." So there's a description in writing of the flow of this argument. God never does bad. Error is bad. How do I explain that? It's the problem of evil applied to epistemology. And he lands in a good place. God's not going to tell me, and I trust that he's good, and that's okay. At this point, I jokingly said, did he become a Calvinist? He did have an option like that. It was called Jansenism. In the 1580s and 90s, there was a Dutch theologian named Cornelius Jansen. And he had some French friends, and they took his ideas to France into a convent in Paris, and it became known as the Port Royal School. And this view in the Catholic Church became known as Jansenism. Now, of course, you couldn't make it a reforming view because the French had already put their foot down on that. The Calvinists had been exterminated, thousands and thousands of them. And so there was a movement in the Catholic Church that held to all the same doctrines that the Calvinists did, on predestination and the whole nine yards. And they were called the Jansenists. And Pascal actually comes out of this group. So was Descartes, I know he was familiar with their ideas, did he hold to their ideas? There is some evidence in this book that he was at least thinking along with them, even if he ultimately rejected the ideas. But it's interesting, because he's thinking about the nature of his error. He's saying, why do they happen? And he comes to a place that I would regard as being so close, yet so far, but really close in one respect to exactly what Edwards said in The Freedom of the Will. What Descartes is going to do is he's going to divide the map of error into two things, intellect and what they would later call intellect versus inclination. But he'll use the word will, and will is just the extension of the intellect between one thing and another. Let's just call them A and non-A. I've got two choices before me, and the way Edwards said it was the will is the mind choosing. It's the most concise definition you can come up with, but it's profound. The will is the mind choosing. And so all parties would agree that in order to have something called the freedom of the will, it has to be this being that's choosing one over the other. This being, from its nature, within the realm, within the stage of natural limitations, is doing this apart from any alien constraint. Now I'm going to use that word advisedly. Because I'm not saying that the will is choosing apart from any constraint, apart from any nature. because that would be self-creation. So that's what Edwards argues against. Descartes doesn't know that yet, because that's 100 years in the future. But Descartes is going to say some things that are very similar to this setup. So the crime is going to be something else. This is a very interesting situation right here. He looks at the intellect and the will as the two spheres in the cause of error. And he says, strictly speaking, no error is to be found in the intellect when properly viewed in this manner. So stop right there. Listen again, and I want you to think through what he's saying. Strictly speaking, no error is to be found in the intellect when properly viewed in this manner. And here we might think of the phrase that Kant uses later on, pure reason. Except here I'm going to take a little bit of license with it. What Descartes is looking at is the intellect is just this window. The will, so a lens, the will is pointing it one way or the other. Can I point it in all sorts of bad directions? Yes. Can it receive information wrongly? Yes. But that's not intellect proper that's at fault. That's the will. Okay? So you see what he's saying there. The intellect in and of itself, when we use that word properly, it's just the lens itself. Okay? And this reminds you of Francis Schaeffer's criticism of Thomas Aquinas that his view of the fall was incomplete. That the intellect was unaffected. That's kind of the way that Descartes, that would be a better criticism of Descartes. He's treating the intellect as if it's this pure principle of a looking. Okay? Now why is he doing this? He wants to blame something for error. He sees error. He's trying to create this system of everything, and he has to explain why error exists. So he begins this section by saying of errors that they are the only things that are indicative of some imperfection in me. And that sounds like megalomania from a biblical perspective. The only things that are indicative of some imperfection in me are errors. And that tells you right away, by the way, Descartes is fully aware of what, I don't want to say it like that. He's fully aware that there is such a thing as sin. He's going to blame sin for some things, but his order is messed up here. Okay, he says the only things that are indicative of some imperfection in me are errors. How does he get to that place? Well, if you start with the assumption that the self is essentially the thinking thing, then the intellect just is purely and simply like a window to the objective world. And so that leaves only one suspect left in the two faculty criminal lineup, and that is the will. The will is what is to blame here. Now, right at that point is when he starts to go Edwards. He says at first that it is only the will or free choice that I experience to be so great in me that I cannot grasp the idea of any greater faculty. And naturally, this doesn't answer the question if you want to go all the way and pursue the wrongdoer here. But why the reason this is interesting is because he's going to define the will in a way that's very clearly something that was probably well aware of these biblical doctrines. So listen carefully to this. He says, willing is merely a matter of being able to do or not do the same thing, that is, of being able to affirm or deny, to pursue or to shun. Or better still, the will consists solely in the fact that when something is proposed to us by our intellect, either to affirm or deny, to pursue or to shun, we are moved in such a way that we are determined to it by no external force, without coercion. Now, right there, if you just read that, you might think, okay, he can go either way. He can either become a libertarian or a compatibilist. So I got to define two more words here. Libertarianism, I don't mean the political party. Libertarianism, with respect to the will, is the ability to do or do otherwise. What is the freedom of the will? Libertarian would say, to do or do otherwise. If I ask a libertarian a follow-up question, do you mean without respect to a prior cause? You mean the will just comes into existence at every moment and just has equal ability to do or do otherwise? He has to mean that, and he does mean that.
A compatibilist, compatibilism,
is the ability to do what one most wants or desires. In other words, my inclination is an actual thing. I am inclined this way more than this way. And I will do, in every case, what I most strongly desire. And so that's not a restraint on my will from an alien nature, but it is a restraint on my will from its own nature. When I prefer chocolate over an hour on the treadmill, it's because the chocolate at that moment is my highest, strongest, most immediate desire. You say, well, what do? When you do the opposite? Then you suppress your strongest desire, right? No. Because at that moment, for whatever reason, I am more persuaded of the benefits of working out versus the chocolate. But in every case, no one does anything other than what is their strongest, immediate desire. That's the real... So the irony of this is that compatibilists actually believe in a free will. Libertarian free will, as it's defined in Arminian theology, actually does not believe in free will. They're calling free will what really amounts to a self-creating will, a will without a nature, a will that is a will and not a will at the same time and in the same relationship. Edwards proves that convincingly and torturously in his book, The Freedom of the Will. If you want to read a book that will give you a headache and will keep you one day on each page, read The Freedom of the Will by Jonathan Edwards, and you will be strangely warmed for a long period of time. I guarantee you. All right, so but listen to where Descartes goes next. He goes there. He goes Edwards. It's kind of unbelievable. I was reading it, I'm like, no. I read this when I was 21, 22, and I didn't know what Jonathan Edwards' argument was, so I didn't catch this. It didn't have any significance for me. I read it later, I'm like, hey, that's just right out of Edwards. So this is what he says. In order to be free, I need not be capable of being moved in each direction. On the contrary, the more I am inclined toward one direction, either because I clearly understand that there is in it an aspect of the good and the true, or because God has thus disposed the inner recesses of my thought, the more freely do I choose that direction. Nor indeed does divine grace or natural knowledge ever diminish one's freedom. Rather, they increase and strengthen it. However, the indifference that I experience when there is no reason moving me more in one direction than in another is the lowest grade of freedom. You see what he just said? In order to be more free, there has to be more me in on it. Makes sense, right? In order for me to be free, I have to be the one drawn to that thing for a reason. Not just like I don't know, what are you doing that for? I don't know. That's less free than saying, that's awesome. Well, don't you want to do its opposite? No. That's more freedom when the clearer I see the superiority of that thing over that thing. And Descartes, a French Catholic, seems to get that more than the Arminians among the Dutch at the same time. So I wonder. I'm just saying. I wonder how much he was reading Calvin, and I wonder how much he was reading the Jansenists. But that's just speculative on my part. I insert it because it's kind of a fun thing. All right. Let's move on. Because here's what he does. He messes even this up. Because of this subjective turn. Because of this subjective turn, he's going to say, now, this is true. But as long as we're blaming somebody, let's blame the will. As if it's detached from that. He forgets everything he's saying. And he makes sin the effect of error, which, no doubt, error leads to more sin. But then he minimizes sin leading to error. He says it this way, the privation that constitutes the very essence of error, the privation, I say, present in this operation, insofar as the operation proceeds from me, but not in the faculty given to me by God, not in the intellect, in its purity, nor even in its operation insofar as it depends upon Him. So what is he doing here? He's still wanting to maintain this pure intellect that if, as long as we're defining intellect, it's just the lens. Now, there's a truth in that in terms of God's design. But to think, therefore, that sin does not affect the intellect is a huge, huge problem. Here's a good metaphor to use in his metaphor. What if the lens is cracked? What if the lens is smudgy as a result of sin? Here's what Jesus says in John chapter 3, verse 19 through 20. And this verse and verses like this should be factored into your epistemology. This is what Jesus said error comes from. John 3, 19 and 20. This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. So compare that to rationalism for a second. The rationalist needs another explanation for error because he's already given himself another definition of light. Okay? He's moved light downstairs from revelation to reason. And even genuflecting and saying that reason is God's gift. Even if it's a Christian rationalist, the emphasis moves light downstairs from revelation down to reason. And so what do you have to do in that? You have to completely ignore the role of sin in the epistemological question. All right. There's some other things that I think are good in rationalism as opposed to empiricism, which I'll get to. Let's break, and then my last session on Descartes will be shorter, and we'll start that in a couple minutes.